Adam Fajcik is a psychotherapist, counselor, and renowned musician and DJ based in London. He is a member of the band Baby Shambles and a solo artist, and he does work with NHS, BPAM, Helps Musicians, and Tonic Music, specializing in work with musicians and treating addiction disorders. He is currently finishing his doctoral studies on musicians and mental health. Adam is an amazing guest, and this is a beautiful episode. I'm so excited for you to listen.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, gotta spiritual growth. Sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more.
So welcome, Adam, to Sober Sex. How are you feeling today?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, it's been a long day, but I'm good. I have energy for this.
Awesome. I'm delighted to hear it. And I know that you are recently not feeling so good. Is that all cleared up?
Yeah. I mean, COVID for the second time. The cough is, it's hanging around still, the cough. But I've got my brain back. It's always my brain that is the biggest struggle. I can't formulate what I need to formulate, but it seems to be holding its own so far. So yeah, better.
Well, from here, you seem to be doing great, and I'm happy to hear that you're feeling better. So where are you? Where are we talking you from?
I'm North London, like on the border of North London, Hertfordshire, that kind of area, out of the busyness, yet not quite in the country.
Awesome. Yes, I recently moved to like the French countryside, and it's definitely nice to be kind of out of the melee of Paris. So I feel this is like, I don't know, I feel like more and more people, especially like strangely music industry people, are kind of exiting city centers just because it feels kind of, I don't know, hard to make work in that environment.
Yeah, it's a lot of people, a lot of energy, sometimes a bit distracting.
No kidding, especially when it's like you've had no kind of social interaction for a couple of years, then it gets real weird.
Yeah, I hear that.
And then, and before we kind of get too deep, what are your pronouns?
My pronouns, I guess, are he, him. I don't tend to use them much. I lean into multiplicity. I mean, I'm a big believer from psychotherapeutically. I work on the strand that we're all different parts and we're all fluid. So in that sense, I try to stay away from being a real kind of binarized view of I am this one thing. But effectively, if I'm superimposing that in the modern framework, I would go with that. But I do lean into that in my work. Therefore, it'd be incongruent of me to say, this is how it is. I think we're all on continuums. You know, my struggle with some of the diversity at the moment is it can become divisive. You know, if you are this, here's your label, there's your badge. It's like, well, what about if I'm feeling a particular more feminine essence in this particular musicking experience or the way I want to dress? Why can't I? Anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying.
No, not at all. I mean, it's a long-form podcast. So, and actually, like the kind of, because we started asking that question. And when I say we, there used to be two other co-hosts, and now it's just me. So it's like a lot of the royal we. But that question was originally asked, and it started to feel a little performative. And so then the kind of concurrent question is like, what's your experience of gender today? So it actually seems like you're kind of, I don't know, that your gender expression or your gender experience is in fact containing multitudes in alignment with like a worldview.
Yeah. I mean, you know, psychologically, psychotherapeutically, I lean into all of that stuff. And it was, I guess, James in, you know, 1800s almost saying, we are different parts. We're different things. We move, we shift. We're fluid in that sense. And I work that way therapeutically, and especially as a creative, we are all that in that way. And, yeah, my experience of gender, I think it's really good that it's now come to the forefront where people can talk about it. But there's an essence of it that I sometimes think that diversity is becoming division now. Oh, this is my tribe.
Yeah.
This is my, I'm like, as a human being, I don't want to be told I'm this and this is how I have to behave. You know, I want to be who I want to be. And I think this is the danger of the threshold of the middle ground of being very cautious, I think, where we are regarding gender. I think it's good that now people are more accepting and knowledgeable, but I think we have to hold caution that we're not just shoehorning people into certain areas where it's almost going back on itself. You know, it's becoming so liberal, the ideas that they're becoming too contained. That's my take on it. So I just try and stay multiplicit. I'm many things. You know, one particular time I might feel more feminine. I might feel more attracted to a certain trait in a certain pop star when I was younger. Who knows? You know, and as a creative, I think it's more important, you know, to have that basis. But that's my take on it.
And no, I think that's a beautiful take. And also, I mean, I think especially like as like a cis identifying man, that like part of the reason we ask the question is just to kind of interrogate and get out of the containers we might find ourselves in, because I feel like not a lot of, because of the kind of the desire to get like shoehorned, like to kind of categorize, you know, even in the more kind of left-leaning political spectrums, that like it can be, I don't know, I don't want to turn the conversation into like identity politics, but I really appreciate the idea of like being able to know and access and honor our parts, right? Which sounds like it's important to your psychotherapeutic practice.
Yeah, and on a bigger level, I think I've always struggled with a sense of rebellion, of being like, I don't want to be told I'm this and I don't want to be that. And even the term, you know, cis-identifying, it makes me go, oh. You know, have I now been reduced to this? And if I wasn't cis-identifying, I'd be something else. But am I then boiled down to that? You know, it's like, I think we're bigger than that. And maybe it's a creative thing where the openness at which we approach our art is infused by this sense of rebellion and nonconformity. So that, you know, I do, and maybe it's a personal thing that I do struggle with kind of being told what I have to be and what I have to do and all of that stuff. So yeah, it's a funnier world at the moment, I think.
Yeah, no kidding. And also, I don't know, I appreciate your ability to kind of name that struggle, and also the like refusal to be part of a club that would have you as a member. Because I think that that's like, yeah, a very relatable sensation. So now that the easy questions are out of the way, jokes, I wanted to talk a little bit about your journey kind of to or from, like, or in between, as it seems like you're kind of holding both sides, like being a high level touring musician and music professional and being a psychotherapist. Like, it seems like music came first, but how did that journey unfold for you?
Yeah, fundamentally, I'm a musician, you know, at my core, although I engage in the dark art of psychotherapy, leaning into psychology now, you know, as I finish my doctorate. But I think at my core, I'm a musician. And the past year, I've been just finishing my thesis, which is, it's a bit of a paradox because it's about how musicians make sense of their musicking and mental health. Yet I've been doing half an hour a day if I'm lucky, and I've really felt it. But anyway, that's the bigger picture. So I've missed that, and I've lost a part of my identity, which I'm now. Mm. Last week, it's like, what a relief. I've started to get all my EP out, and the club night we're going to be running. I feel connected and re-engaged to life. But yeah, my journey, where did it start? It wasn't really formally started. I didn't start it by going to lessons. There was no musicians really in my family. I think I didn't really start like an old keyboard when I was very young. And I really enjoyed the emotionality of playing just simple melodies. And it felt really nice in my body. I thought, God, mm-hmm. It was nice. And it makes me feel maybe better through some of my family stuff I was going through. And then started playing drums at about 16, 17, I think, around then. But no formal, this is what I'm going to do. I just enjoyed it. And then I think alongside instrumental playing, there's a lot of identity. You know, at a certain age, we get into certain music. I mean, I was probably listening to a lot of pop music. And then we find our own sounds, and then we find our niche and our gang and our culture. So getting into bands on my estate and the socialism of that, and kind of engaging in all of their culture and their ethos, and getting my own identity, haircuts, what we dress, certain bands. At the same time, I was, you know, into late teens, kind of failed everything at school, getting chucked out of school, getting into trouble with the police, not really having any sense of future. And I was on a YTS scheme, which was like a scheme brought in by the government to get kids off of signing on the dole, which it was back then, where you sign and claim benefits. It was really low paid, you know, you're treated pretty poorly. So I was doing that. And then how can I describe it? I was massaging the system illegally. I got found out and I was about to kind of get taken down the legal path with that. And was planning bans and using substance to kind of regulate myself. And then a friend of mine took his own life. Unfortunately, he'd just come out of prison. He'd just been released. He was only young, you know, and he'd taken his own life. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, really. It sent me into a real psychological, I mean, I'm hesitant to use the word breakdown, but I guess if you're talking about it, it was a breakdown of the psychological status quo I was at. Everything just kind of collapsed into.
Yeah.
And music really helped that, you know, music listening mainly. It was the only thing I could do, listening to music that would almost make me feel alive. And I could wrap myself in it in this lovely quilt. Not so much playing, but the listening. And then I was lucky enough to see like a bereavement counsellor in about 12 sessions. And for the first time ever, somebody said to me, what do you want to do? I'm like, wow, what a big question. I didn't think I had a choice. She helped me to get into a college at 19. I'd done like it's called a BTEC, which is like the lowest level GCSE level, and moved out of the area I was in. And for me, I had nothing else to do. I didn't know anyone. So I just practiced a lot and realized that if I put the time in, I could achieve. So suddenly started to realize I could achieve lots of different things through just practicing. And that was music theory. That was piano, drums, and guitar. Then after 2 years, we go to university. I thought, I'm never going to get into university because I've done 2 years of study and that's it. And then managed to get in onto a jazz degree course.
Oh, wow. So yeah, it sounds like you're well.
That was one of my favorite drummers.
you put in the work and the results were there for you.
I didn't really practice drums much, but that's what I get. I think they were desperate.
Everybody needs drummers.
So I applied and they were asking me about my favorite drummers. And now I've got an in-depth knowledge of jazz drummers. I love all that stuff. But at the time, I didn't know anything about jazz. I didn't even know why I was there. But anyway, I think my two favorite drummers were like Mitch Mitchell and Alan Wren from the Stone Roses. Kind of looked at me with one eyebrow raised.
Like jazz.
I got in. I was well out of my depth. You know, people have been studying for a long time and I guess I was just like meat and potatoes drummer. But anyway, you know, got in there, didn't study particularly hard on that degree, but it was great for learning to DJ and to start running club nights. And then at the end of that, I realized I'm going to have to try and work out how to earn some money. So got into kind of teaching, done a PGCE. So in the UK, you do like a 2-year teacher training course. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to try and make it as a musician playing jazz, there's hardly any money in that. So the goal was to play some jazz stuff that I enjoyed doing, do some teaching, do some wedding gigs and all that stuff, maybe a few sessions and join a few commercial bands.
Very, very pragmatic approach, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I was a bit older, you see. So for me, it's like, God, I need to kind of fall on my own 2 feet now because I didn't go to college till I was 19, 20. So I'd lost a lot of years just flaking about doing things that shouldn't have been done on the housing estate I grew up on. As I said, you know, my life then was looking at myself at late teens. There was no prospects. It was like, what are you going to do? I had no qualifications, factory, low-level crime. It's like the choices were restricted. So I was a bit older going there. So I knew that I had to kind of put it together. So anyway, done this teacher training. So I was a secondary school music teacher, which I really enjoyed. But I knew that I weren't going to do that. I just wanted to superimpose that training and that pay scale into being an instrumental teacher, because then I could teach. I could do like 3 days, 5 hours, and then I'd have 4 days a week to do all my musicking, whatever I want to do.
Nice.
So I've done that for a while. There's loads of covers bands, loads of different bands, signed to small labels, still doing the jazz stuff, played a lot of vibraphone as well at the time, but mainly it was drumming and vibraphone stuff. And then, we'd done like a jazz album, which done well with a good friend of mine. And I was running club nights and DJing kind of house music. And also I'm a big fan of 60s soul and kind of boogaloo and soul jazz and that stuff. So I've got a lot of records. And yeah, and I was in a band supporting Baby Shambles with my friend Patrick. And a guy called James was also managing it, who I knew very well. And the band at that point was struggling. I think it was about to implode, lots of drug stuff. And the girl that's playing drums at that particular time wanted to move away from all that. So she did, and they had a vacancy and asked me. So I jumped into that. And that was the inception of Baby Shambles, really.
Wow. I mean, it's quite a trajectory from being asked for the first time, like what you wanted to do with your life, to like kind of being, I don't know, catapulted into that. I mean, and then you're like, and then the work begins, you know, like,
yeah,
that's really exciting. And it sounds also like, that you were quite kind of somatically sensitive to like the music being like a life-saving, process or, yeah, a kind of a rung to hold on to.
Massively, yeah. And I think I lost that slightly in Baby Shambles. I think for the first time, I perceive it as musicking, so it's all these different factors of it. And what became more important to me then was probably more the validation, the elevation, you know, the sun in the autographs. And I think I had some wounds from my past where that stuff was incredibly, I was magnetized towards all of that stuff. This sense of self, great, I can be the guy in a magazine. Yeah. And
I mean, validation is a hard drug to resist, you know.
It was good, you know, and at the time it was really, it was an amazing experience. But over time, I think I'd lost that emotional foundation with what music had always meant to me. Mm-hmm. And when I, you know, as that young teen thinking, right, what am I going to do? This is what I'm going to do and be a musician. It wasn't, that stuff wasn't around there. So I think that, you know, the commercial success definitely moved me away from what music had always meant. It was grand. It was an amazing experience, but I think I'd lost it. I'd slightly lost connection to that embodied sense of the importance of it. So yeah, it was an interesting experience. And I think it took me a while after coming out of the band to really reconnect with it. And of course, coming out of that band experience for me, there's a whole rich array of experiences, but it was that propelled me to go into therapy, because I'd come out of this experience, you know, suddenly with responsibility as a young child and real life, and thinking, right, now what am I going to do? I was lucky enough that I had a career in teaching before, so I went to start to doing that, to go back to that. Whilst lucky enough to get offered some residencies in London, DJing a lot of house music and releasing solo stuff. So it was a nice grounding to come out of, and then in therapy really reconnected with some of my old wounds, which I think had stretched me away during that commercial experience, really stretched me away from the importance of music for me. And now I feel really privileged. I'm back in connection with that, you know, doing something really valuable, still releasing solo records, still DJing, whilst, you know, being involved in, I guess it's music, it's psychotherapy with musicians, and also light music psychology, because there's certain elements of music I use in that. I'm not a music therapist, and looking into more psychological ways of being now as well. I'm quite lucky if finally, and it's only been the past few weeks where everything's come together.
Oh, wow. It's very lucky to be talking to you now.
It's only 8 years. It's been an 8-year journey. You know, start with like training to be a counselor, then you train to be a psychotherapist. And then for me, the bringing all of myself together and all the previous qualifications. I also done when I got out of the band, I'd done a master's in music technology, so music production.
Oh, wow.
To learn. It's my own. I was always interested in electronic music as well, so I learned to produce all my records, so I know a lot about production as well. My thesis in that was to do with how emotion is impacted through production techniques. Mm-hmm. So I sent out a scratchy demo of me on guitar to 20 people, then I sent out the produced version, you know, using the sound box, using reverbs, compression, all the tools we have as electronic producers, and got the feedback and worked out which was the most emotionally impactful. Anyway, that was the thesis for my master's.
Oh my God. It's really cool also, I think, how you're kind of combining both like the practical and the academic, because I think that, like, I don't know, my creative partner just got, like, literally on Friday got his PhD in music ethnology. And I think that this is kind of an interesting path forward as we, like, as you say, like, uncover what the importance is of musicking and how to incorporate that in other areas of our lives. So it's really cool that it seems to have kind of been a common thread through, like, your post, I don't know, post Baby Shambles careers, plural.
Yeah, and it's bigger than that. You know, sometimes, you know, you're Adam Shambles, you're this, but then people realize that. And for me, yeah, there's a part of what I did in that. So I'm lucky enough that I've got experience of being a musician, you know, being like a commercial and corporate musician, a music teacher, And then doing this music production master's, having all the industry experience, and also managing the band. It was a period of time where I was involved with all the decisions, taking the corporate reins of that band, whether that be signing publishing deals, booking tour buses. So I have an innate experience of that from both sides. And then as soon as I finished my master's in emotion, I was going to do a PhD in production. I got a scholarship to do, they called it advanced music production or music technology and emotion. But that was pushing me into music psychology. And I thought, I'm into it, but my area isn't quite music psychology. It's not music therapy. It's psychotherapy with musicians using music. So then I decided to train as a psychotherapist. And say that was the 5-year journey. Trained to be a counselor, then you trained to be a psychotherapist. Although, don't get me started on that, but some people are marketing themselves and they're not. So that was that. And then the 3-year doctorate, which I've just finished, which brings all of that together. And I'm halfway through the book of the thesis, which includes literature research on how professional music in is impacted and mental health, my own experience and my research findings, how they all come together, but kind of framed through my experience and putting that into psychological theory as well. So I'm just halfway through that and then just caught in different publishers. So there's that. So I do feel like I've come to this point now, and I don't know what I'll do in the future, but you know, it will still involve all that stuff. So yeah, and then I just need to record my EP, and I'll tour that later in the year. Just it'll be solo with maybe some backing tracks. I don't know yet. Electronica, and relaunching a club night. I don't do much teaching now, and I work with musicians as a psychotherapist, and I do a lot with different charities. I'm heavily involved with a charity called Tonic Music for Mental Health. I got involved with them because they actively use music as well. A lot of charities in the UK or companies are like, we do mental health with musicians.
Yeah.
I find that many don't really understand what even that involves. But for me, the way that Tonic were using music as well. So they'd like, you know, they would gift people that were struggling with addiction guitars and do music workshops, which was my thing as well. Alongside supporting people that were just in the industry, you know, as tour managers, etc. So I do a lot with them.
So wait, just to kind of pause there, like for your psychotherapy practice, because you're one of your main kind of focuses is obviously with musicians, like, you know, when we think about music therapy, that's obviously a different kind of track than psychotherapy, but you're talking about like dealing with, I don't know, emotions via music. So how do you, like, what does that look like in practice?
The first thing is language. You know, you're talking about sometimes you're talking about people and what we have a window of tolerance. So we all have an emotional tolerance. When that squeezes down because we're tired or we've been taking substances, we can talk about that. Just using language that people understand, like, you know, this is the equivalent of like a compressor. So a lot of that, or thinking of terms of emotion and working in parts and say, well, you know, you've got this part that, for instance, might get really angry when someone tries to connect with you. And what music, how would you frame that musically? What piece of music would it be? So there's that, there's the language, but also a lot of the reflective practice that I find a lot of musicians don't engage in a reflective practice with their instruments. So they play, but they play towards an artifact. So they might have to deliver the album. They might have to deliver the tour. Most professional musicians I work with have forgotten the act of playing, the act of just sitting down, plucking a string and seeing how that resonates in your body. You know, these kind of things, or just playing a simple melody. So it's not something I actively bring in and use so much, but it's something that I make people more aware of as musicians. I mean, part of me would like to train to be a music therapist, but there's elements of it that I'm not that interested in. So I think my next step would be, but my thesis covers, it's transdisciplinary. So again, you know, going with my pluralistic fluidity, it brings together music psychology, music therapy, psychotherapy, music identity theories, you know, there's
parts
four,
work,
four
like, there's like a lot areas. Going on.
It is. So there's four key areas because, and this is what where we started. When you start, most research for musicians is musicians touring or this, that, and they're all siloed. You know, it's like the same thing as sometimes the gender stuff. You're this. It's like, no, we're all bigger than this. We're more than that. You know, I'm Adam in the middle trying to straddle these grounds that are always moving. Same as when we create music, it's the same thing. We're not just like, this is, you know, this is house music at 127 BPM. It's like, no, it's not. And we all know it's not. And I think it's good that culture's moving this way now, because my thesis concerns initially it was non-classical musicians. It's the only term I could find.
Which still remains very broad, yeah.
But there's those two distinctions really in the literature anyway, the research literature, because we know classical musicians are easy to distinguish because generally they would have had a conservatoire training. Mm-hmm. And it's been very generalized here, but, you know, would have probably come from a higher social mobility. If there's more a stereotypical, what you would assume to be a classical musician, you know, there's no judgment on that. So I couldn't find a term. I've now called them popular musicians, which is everything that's not classical, because a guy called Frith, who just said it's everything, which, and that's folk, jazz, electronica, because I couldn't contain it. Mm-hmm. Because all my research participants are non-classical. So that's how we could hold it. And that's how I understand it. You know, I do many different things, and one day I might be messing about with a certain EQ. The next day I might be doing a 2-5-1 on a hard bop standard. But it all comes together in my own music. So that's what they're based within, really. And it's that, you know, it's the fluidity within that pool of people. It's the same thing. You know, it's the same where we can be all these different things, and we can straddle these disciplines. And that's all right as well. You don't have to silo us. You don't have to say this is research on how musicians struggle with substance abuse, because that substance abuse will be in context. Mm-hmm. And I think this is playing out across the field now. But it's scary, yeah, because people need that safety in it.
Yeah, in the genrefication kind of. And also I think it's like now there's this like the push-pull of like having to kind of name what you are and what you're good at in order to kind of be able to market oneself, and then also having to wear a ton of different hats in order to actually survive in the music industry in like a lived sense. So it's there. I imagine that both you and your clients are kind of, I don't know, that there's like, you must be put into a box and you can't be put into a box. It's kind of a tricky paradox to dance in.
Yeah. And we want to be put in a box because it's safe. But again, I do believe that creatives generally are easier, more able to deal with being fluid, this fluidity, you know, this sense of, yeah, well, one day maybe I want to be more contained here. The next day, I just want to make some angry kind of guitar music with loads of effects. I'm predominantly a musician. It's the same as my instruments. Yeah, I play guitar and I express myself on acoustic because I love the way it feels. And I haven't got cartloads of equipment with me. It's easier. But on another day, I might want to do a drum piece. You know, it's the same. Maybe I'm feeling more feminine today. Maybe I'm feeling more masculine today. Maybe I've heard a piece of music which brings that out in me. Maybe I haven't. It's this sense of parts. And for me, psychotherapy is about amalgamating them and being fluid in them and being mm-hmm. flexible so we have choice. That's how I see therapy. That's how I view life, my musicing as well, really, in terms of all the hats I wear. So,
yeah. No, it's beautiful. I mean, I'm personally like during COVID, there was the effort to kind of potentially diversify my output and become starting to train in Gestalt therapy. And so there's a lot of the kind of similarities in terms of like honoring the needs and the parts that are functional and being able to move fluidly between them. And it's beautiful. I think it's a really beautiful, like when it stopped scaring me so much, it started to be such a rich and healthy way to live, you know?
Yeah.
And so I read some, like you mentioned dabbling with some substances, in your kind of earlier years. And then you mentioned being in recovery, on your website. And so can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, again, recovery, you know, I struggle with that word. Yeah. I don't really use it as such. I think for me, it's, you know, recovery, sobriety. I think it's a fluid process. I think, you know, you could start going into, are you an addict? Aren't you an addict? Where's the line? Some addicts can still, if they're in the drink, they can still have a glass of wine on the weekend and it not totally consume them. I have friends that can't even, you know, go near a pub because they'll end up in a crack den 2 hours later. So I think, again, approaching it with this fluidity, which isn't always helpful because people like black and white, they like to be told, you know, you are this, this is what you need to do to resolve it. And I think we're too complex for that. So in regards to no longer using substances or things outside myself to fix how I feel inside, yeah, you could frame that as I'm in recovery or I no longer need those things. I think a lot of that was helped through psychotherapy. I think a lot of it was helped getting back into music as well. I think, you know, being able to, I've always used stuff in the past to fix how I feel a certain way, and therefore this fixes it, I feel better. And then, as you know, over time, you don't even have that process. You just reach for the thing, whatever that might be. And I see it all the same. You know, I think it's all the same stuff. It's coming from a place of trying to fix how we feel. But I'm at the point where, yeah, I no longer need that. And maybe that's therapy. Maybe that's getting older. Maybe that's, I definitely use music to regulate myself. You know, I think I lost a lot of that during the band years. Whether that be through listening, through playing, through composing, you know, any of these things we can do. And in relationships as well, I think it's always been a massive social element of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, how is the kind of losing the attachment to substances being like, how has it transformed your life or your work or your relationships?
I think they're healthier.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to paint myself, you know, contextually to some of the people I've worked with. I was, you know, I was a light engager, but I undoubtedly used it across time to fix how I was feeling about myself. Yeah, because some of the people I've been around is like another level, and I think I wasn't that deep into it. But I think the relationships are much richer. I think, you know, even therapy and stuff like that. I think I learned how to be in relationship through therapy, which is also a key part of my component, is this training ground. It's like, okay, we've both, you know, my wounds are processed or in the process. It's always work in process, to an extent where I can now use my own parts and reflectivity and wounds to sit with you and to see what, you know, you enact with me. It's a relational encounter. I don't have all the answers. It's not like, right, this is what you need to do to get better. And the further I've gone, even into my doctorate after 8 years, you realize that the more you learn, the more you realize there are no hard truths. Mm-hmm. And my beef with like Instagram and stuff like that is these kind of people that know hardly anything and they're pertaining to be these gurus, and you think, wow, because the more you know, in 10 years time, you realize that you question everything. And it's complex, and the person in front of you isn't going to respond to the same way as someone else. It's a unique experience with every person. I couldn't have had those unique experiences if I was still, you know, using stuff to fix my emotional state. So I'm more able to self-regulate now, I think, through music, and the relationships are much richer.
That's beautiful. And I think also, I don't know, it seems like you're very, very, perhaps, you know, having gotten a PhD in this, you're very kind of self-aware when it comes to how you do regulate. And I think that that's like, as an addict in recovery, it took me a really long time to kind of like even have that level of presence with self and also presence in relationship to be able to kind of name and, yeah, and in fact regulate. You know, it'd be like first the only instinct was numb, and then it kind of over time it got, as you said, like a richer or more fine experience with all that stuff. And you know, I'm sober through 12 step, and in a lot of mutual aid and 12 step programs, we talk about like the struggle being the thing that uniquely qualifies us to be of service. And it sounds like that might also be a through line in your work, that not only like through, you know, having such a rich and varied experience in the music industry, but also it seems like very, like I'm moved by how you talk about music being where it is in your life. You know, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the importance of it, I think that definitely helps me to take a music-centric view of musicians. This is why generally I feel more connected sometimes to people that are musicians rather than in the industry themselves. I think there's a difference. And I always see, you know, some therapists come from a commodifier perspective. And that sounds like a negative, dirty word. It's not, but you've been in the industry and you've come from being a commodifier. So your job is to commodify the artist. I think that's a unique experience.
It's just like so juxtaposed to like your whole, like the full spectrum of the human experience as found in our multitudes.
it's a continuum, but viewing it like that, you know, you've come from a place where predominantly you spent most of your time in the service of trying to promote musicians and to earn them wealth or to get them exposure. I think it's a different place if you've come from a place where you've played an instrument on a daily grind, you've had that discipline, you've been through the highs and the lows of just internal success. You know, I can't quite get that drum groove yet to the metronome. I can't quite get that drum syncing as much as I'd like because I can't get the EQ right. These internal frustrations that are really hard as musicians. And then how is that going to be judged by people? And then you superimpose that in the music industry. There's all that tension already. I think you don't really understand that nuance if you've been in the industry on a label and stuff like that, unless you're also a musician. So I think I approach it from that music-centric perspective, which undoubtedly helps me, not only in terms of the language and some of the self-regulation strategies as scaffolding I invite musicians to use, but just that, just like what it's like to be a musician, let alone what it's like to be a musician where you're being thrown around, your self-esteem's being moved around all the time by 1 minute publisher dropping you because you're not getting enough syncs, the next minute a book deal lifting you up and saying you're going to be the greatest thing ever. You know, that's really difficult if you have an unstable sense of self, which most of us do. You know, it gets easier through time, through therapy, I think. But I think putting that in there. And then the additional third part of that triangle is the media exposure. You know, in the band I was in, you were just under scrutiny all the time from, you know, having private communications hacked to all these things to being on the front pages of those papers to the other side, the positive side, to, you know, attracting people to come to your shows because they're not sure what's going to happen. You know, I can't pretend that was about me. I was involved in a band where the lead singer was that magnet. But that, so those three components are hard anyway. So when I sit with a lot of profiled musicians, I think this sense of stuff that is unsaid that you naturally get, you don't have to explain it to someone. And I think that is really helpful for me when I first started doing this. And the reason I started it is because I struggled to find a therapist that understood that. There were musicians, maybe some that were in the industry, but not many that had also had that media scrutiny, that what it really felt like to be put under that spotlight. So that's, you know, another reason and impetus of why I started it as well, thinking there's a huge void here for people that have that experience that don't really have anyone that understands them. That's also part of the book as well, part of like, it's not like a self-help book. It's like, this is what we go through. So if you're a counselor or a psychotherapist, psychologist, here's my insight. Here's some robust, you know, literature, which has gone through an analytical process. And here's the other boring literature, which, you know, is siloed. It's siloed literature, which I've kind of stitched together via myself and via the participants that have kindly given me their life stories as well. So, yeah, and then bringing that all forward, you know, through the charities I work with in my private practice, alongside, for me, it's incredibly important that I'm musicking, I'm out there playing, I'm still touring, still, you know, the whole part of it. Okay, now I've got to record this track. Do I get someone to mix it? And then I've got to, you know, I've got to get that pressed up. Do I do crowdfunding? And then I've got to go and do all the horrible social media stuff. Then I've got to book the tours. Some of those dates are going to be cancelled. I'm going to end up with a travel lodge bill. All those small things. How am I going to get out there? Do I take a bass player? These small,
yeah.
You know, how much merch do I take? You know, all these things that you forget you have to do. And it's like, oh, this is hard work now. But I think it's integral for me to do it. And on a bigger scale, you know, the bigger band stuff, when that happens, that'll be on a different level. And the DJing stuff, all of that, you know, I'm lucky enough to be connected a lot with Pioneer. We're about to do another documentary and all of that stuff. You know, do I go back and do another residency in London? Do I want the 1 till 4 a.m. slot in West London? It's like, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but there's a lot that to have to kind of like survey the entire landscape of both like the psychotherapy academic practicing element plus the entire music career. Like, I feel a little overwhelmed just hearing about it. But I don't know. I mean, you seem to have like a very strong like lay of the land when it comes to the contemporary struggles surrounding like fame, addiction, mental health, and like what the music industry specifically kind of, I don't know, how it plays with those things. Would you mind speaking a little bit about a little bit to that? Because I do think between that and like digital streaming platforms and the present kind of uncertainty of a touring industry, like there is a kind of modern challenge facing touring musicians specifically, but music industry professionals generally, that we haven't really seen before.
Yeah, hugely. And part of my research also, because it spans ages, some of the research participants are younger than others. Part of my criticism was they're going to have a very different experience coming into it now. You know, you have to juggle a lot. You have to be creative in terms of how you can generate income and even navigating social media. I think if I would have been 19 and someone said to me, what do you want to do now? I would have gone maybe music, but maybe not quite as what I anticipated, because I don't really enjoy, you know, I don't do the TikTok stuff. I think I'm going to have to promote the part of the book that's coming out a bit later, I'm going to have to do all that.
You look so deeply unhappy as you say that. And I relate. Yeah. It's just like, oh, God.
And every musician I talk to, I do a lot with help musicians, and the musicians get this like one check-in, and we just talk about the struggles and the stresses. And they all say, I hate doing it and I really dislike it, but it's part of the game. And it is part of the game. You know, it's part of now most people are being fed their exposure to new creatives on those platforms, which I think is a huge shame, but this is part of it. I think that's a massive stress, because as much as you want to go on there, do content and get out, you're sucked in, and suddenly someone's doing something better than you and this makes you angry. There's all that. So I think that's innately difficult. I think the reduction of income has made it more difficult now, because you're thinking, well, how am I going to generate money? Whereas in the old days, you could go out and you could sell a lot more merch. Mm-hmm. I think in the UK, the venues are closing at a ridiculous scale. We're getting this huge, big gap in the middle now. Small venues or your stadium, you know, your Ed Sheeran doing 4 days. And it's like, something's got to give.
Yeah, the mid-cap is really suffering.
It's horrible. And you know, the NTIA, the nighttime industries, they're trying to impose this levy to say when you go to a big stadium, a portion of that ticket sale goes through to grassroots. Because if not, in 10 years' time, we're not going to have that kind of level of generation of income. We can already see now, if you look at the amount of heritage acts, and I'm guilty of that, you know, I guess I'm part of a heritage act, but the amount they can just go out and in the same old festivals, which is good for them. But where's, you know, the 10, 20 years time, what's going to come through? And I think I've always pushed for that, because I got into music through that. If it wasn't those grassroots scenes, I would never have got where I've got to. This is why I do have a bit of a struggle sometimes with like the Live Nations and the big conglomerates that, and you know, they're the Amazons and we all use them, but I think something needs to shift. If not, it's all going to dry up. So I think there's that new innate modern struggle with the industry, and people can also stay in their niche now. You know, you just stay in one area. Was in sound really old, but in the old days, you know, there'll be certain NME or Melody Maker that I would go to, everyone would know about it. But now it's so sporadic.
Yeah. The press angle is very difficult, because it's either like, it feels like it's everywhere or nowhere kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have to do something really kind of groundbreaking, or something which is, and we're predominantly a visual culture now, so you have to look a certain way. You know, you're especially in non-classical popular musics, where it's not about the music, more so it's about
art direction.
It's art direction. It's the ethos you're selling. It's how you look, more so than the actual, you know, the shifting of air pressure that we're picking up in our ears, which is, yeah, it's always been that way, I guess. But I think it's more so that way now. And people's attention spans, you know, you come and you go like this. I think it's a really difficult time. I run a peer group every week for musicians, and there's so many that are struggling now and thinking, okay, well, how do we diversify? Because we get so much from our musicking, yet we can't pay the bills. And you know, that, and if somebody wants to start a family, then what? Does it stop? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of musicians, I always knew that teaching is always going to be an element of that. But that's becoming a bit more problematic now, even with, you know, the digital world we're in. I think it's a really tough world. I don't think there are any answers. I think it's driven by pure love and motivation and a lot of luck. But undoubtedly, it's getting harder and harder. And I think something has to give. I think they really need to levy these small venues, or also work out a way of levying some of the big earnings to give to younger artists that are coming through. And I know in Europe, they fund music and art a lot more than they do in our country.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as an American living in France, like the France's kind of cultural funding system is incredible, but like, I don't know how people are surviving in my native country. You know, it's like, it's really a miracle if anybody kind of keeps their head above water without like three other jobs. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's the reason we talk about it is because I think also the social media platforms have such a pressure to perform success that a lot of people aren't kind of seeing that it's a universal struggle, you know, that it's like, they're like, well, they have like 7,000 tour dates this month. Like, what's wrong with me? And it's like, honey, like, unless I think we are talking about it and kind of airing the conversations, that it's very easy to feel like the odd man out, or like one is, can take it personally, or they're doing something wrong. And the reality is actually much more challenging than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of luck. I think we take care of business to a basic level. We can go out there. An art is subjective. yet then to kind of break to that next state, who knows? I think it's been in the right place, right time. I think a lot of that. And the other thing I always caveat with, and it sounds really brutal, but we all still choose to do it. But, you know, I was saying that another part of what I always offer to musicians, and it sounds quite brutal and blunt, but we are all choosing to do this. You know, we're all choosing to engage in a lifestyle that we know is going to be hard. I mean, and I say that I done well out of it for a certain period. I was lucky. But saying that, I was also a working musician. I was doing the weddings. I was doing the engagement parties. I was DJing, all that stuff as well, alongside being a creative. But, you know, we all choose to do it. And I think the other thing to take away is a lot of musicians are incredibly resilient. So that transferable skill of like, shit's got to get done. I think you can't buy that. I think as a musician, I always think musicians, they pick themselves up off the floor all the time. They push through. So that as a transferable skill is huge. Many people don't have that. And you learn that. You learn that through sheer grit of being a musician, not being in the music industry, because I think if you're in an industry and you're, you know, you're an agent or something, you don't face those same problems. As a musician, it takes discipline to practice every day, whether that's practicing your editing, your production skills, whether that's practicing on a, you know, a piano, a drum kit, or your voice. You have to do it. You need an element of discipline. And that evokes an element of resilience, and that's an incredible asset and skill which many people overlook. But you know, we choose to do it, and here we are. We're actively engaging in this struggle, and it's not a fair world, but we are choosing to do it.
No, that's really, I think that's a very helpful and healthy way to look at it, that it is in fact a choice. And granted, like, there, I don't have that many other skills, to be fair, but I do think that, like, it sounds like your kind of pragmatism when it comes to being like, well, in addition to being a resilient musician, like a curiosity for the academic world, a love of teaching, like there's a lot of things that you kind of had tools in your toolkit to kind of move forward in a way that actually felt really like a positive experience. Because I think part of the issue that we're facing right now is because of when somebody kind of like, again, performs success or has this like strong identity as a musician on a social media platform or in the public eye, to be like, oh no, I've decided to take an academic route or to be a teacher or to change jobs entirely, can feel like a blow to the ego. And for you, it actually sounds like it was kind of a way to a more rich existence and in fact, a better relationship with your musicking.
Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. I think having the underpinning of a lot of the literature research on my literature review I had to do is like 20,000-30,000 words, and a lot of reading through. And it's like a lot of it didn't resonate. It's sterile. Some objective person has measured this and that. And it's like, this isn't my experience of this. So a lot of my lived experience was also to kind of challenge a lot of that stuff. And it's really filled in the gaps for me musically. It's helped me to get an overview of how people view it, and also my own formulation through psychotherapy, you know, working more with musicians, it's been really helpful in that. So in that sense, integrating all of that has been really useful. And it's such a different way of, you know, we know that the different parts of the brain, but, you know, when I get on an instrument now, it's like, wow, this is such easy work compared to, I find academia really hard. You know, and I always say, I'm not an academic. I've got like whatever, 3 postgrads, masters and a doctorate. And I don't say that, you know, oh, it's great. I can show off of all that stuff. It's brilliant. But it's hard. You know, it's really, I find it really difficult to focus. I mean, you know, there's the tentative ADHD stuff. It's a whole other world. But I find it really difficult. You know, I find it difficult to read. I find it difficult to engage and ingest information. Once it's in, it's fine, but getting it in, you know, it's really, really tough for me. So this doctorate has been a real labor of love, and I think it's underpinned as hopefully people can read it and go, whoa, he gets it, you know, and I understand. And I've seen someone that can not only articulate it, like in, you know, Bruce Springsteen's autobiography, where they've talked about their thing, they're able to frame it in the context of other people, and then frame it with what clever people are talking about in the literature and in psychological theory as well, and pin it all together. And that's the hope, really. The hope has always been to integrate myself and also help people to kind of recognize it and you know, not feel isolated and weird as we all do as musicians, and to go, wow, this is interesting. It's got real depth, because we read these autobiographies and they're brilliant, but they're kind of quite one-dimensional. Mm-hmm. they're generally written by people that, you know, are getting tons of publishing every month. So it's cool. They can get a couple of lambs and live on a farm. Brilliant. But for a lot of them, it's not quite the case. So I think I'm really interested in that kind of lower level professional musician experience.
Really. Well, I think, yeah, I mean, especially as we observe the kind of working class of musicians being kind of filtered out because it is such a challenging industry to survive in these days, it seems like that's actually a very important voice to elevate and to support. You talk about integration, and I'm curious on like on a personal level, how you manage to kind of integrate like your musicking practice, your psychotherapy practice, and then like your life stuff, you know, being a husband and a father, kind of how do you manage to not feel deeply overwhelmed at all times? The world wants to know.
Well, I guess I have a slightly selfish element to me, which I think all artists and musicians have to have. And it's this constant balance thinking, hold on, there's not been enough attention to relationship A, B, or C. That needs to be renegotiated. But I can quite easily get quite self-absorbed, which can be really good at times, but in other times not so good. It's an ongoing reflective process. I haven't got it all nailed. Maybe I'll have it nailed one day, then the next day it's like, this needs to be readdressed. And, you know, people who want my attention versus me wanting to give attention in relationships. And the music element, that's a lot easier to integrate with the academic stuff, I think. Because I guess there are four areas. There's the clinical practice, there's the music element, there's the academic stuff, and then there's the family life. And, you know, there's a lot more than that. But I don't really know, actually. I think it's going to become easier when the academic stuff's done. Mm-hmm. I don't feel as natural in that space as the other three spaces. I feel quite natural as a clinician. I feel quite natural as a musician. I feel quite natural in relationships. But the academic stuff, I kind of feel a bit of an imposter in that sense. It's not really. And it's not something I'll do it lightly going forward because it's part, again, of this tonic music for mental health area I'm involved with, where they're going to be actively doing research, but not to the extent I'm doing it now. There's too many rules. Mm-hmm. There's too many. You know, I've just gone through my references. Oh, no, you haven't put a dot here. It's not APA 7. It's like, I don't fucking care. I really don't.
The bibliography proves to be the most difficult part.
I have to care because it's part of the person marking it, but I've expressed what I express. And like a piece of music, you just let it fly. Yeah. With this stuff, you know, so for me, it's not, I think I'm not on a natural person that attends to detail like that. I just want to create and throw it out and then create something else. Rather than, you know, it's enough. For me, academic, that's enough. And I think I've done my stint. I mean, I think there's another master's.
Oh my God. You look horrified at the prospect, but also like that it must be done.
I'll bang one out in a few months. No, you know, but yeah, it's a constant juggle. I think it's complex. The most difficult one is the academia. It's not an area that I feel particularly comfortable in. You know, I'm not going to be a professor. I'm a clinician, and I'm a musician fundamentally, and a clinician on top of that. That's how I perceive myself. I think I couldn't do it without daily musicking. I couldn't do the clinical work without that. That's who I am. And I think that will be carried through all my life. It'll always be there. I'm sure I'll retire doing clinical work when I'm a ripe old age. But, you know, it saved me. If I think about it, really, without that core of musicking, identity, affect regulation, it's carried me through some incredibly difficult times. And it does. You know, we all have those pieces of music that we resort back to, whether that's nostalgia or all those things that music psychology tells us it offers us. It's always there, you know, as an attachment. It's never going to leave us. You know, it's those things that from our deep wounds that we carry forward with music. And then we end up in an industry where it becomes a bit more difficult. Yeah. But fundamentally, yeah, the music stuff is, I think, my foundation.
And that's beautiful. I feel very, I feel moved when you say that, like, because I too have had a life that's been saved by music and kind of, yeah, allowed to proceed as a result. And then when you add it as a profession, it becomes a little bit more tricky, but, it's such a pleasure to remember the point.
And what it does for us all, you know, and it's this anomaly, isn't it? Because what is it? I mean, you know, people have written about it since the days of Pythagoras, of what it does and what different modes do. But I believe that, you know, I can sit and, especially guitar wise, I can just pluck one E string and then say, all right, how does that minor third sound? God, that ninth just makes me feel really what emotion would I apply to that? Those kind of things, you know, huge, massive. Or I can play a piano chord and it can almost reduce me to tears, or elevate me to tears, depending on how we're looking at it. Then I can add like a, you know, like a flattened fifth on that. And what does that do? It's this, wow, this is so rich. This world is so rich. And that's pure musicking. That's nothing to do with the bullshit of the industry, really. And this is what I try to remind the musicians I work with. Say, don't ever lose that sense of what music is, bigger than the, you know, the ethos, bigger than the look, bigger than the chart position, bigger than the streams. Because if you lose sense of that, I think, and you know, happened to me, I feel that's what went on with me. I'd lost the real essence of it. It didn't move me the same way.
So you had mentioned a master's degree might be next in the cards for you. But is there any other thing that feels like where the next kind of few months are heading for you?
Yeah, I've got to finish an EP for Roses, King's Castle. So that's my solo thing. That'd be my sixth solo album, I think.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's good. It's just that I've got a nice fan base. It's a small community. It's just me and a guitar, I think, this time. I'm not sure, but I'll see. But that's lovely to have that. I've got to put that all together. I might record it myself and then take it to another producer to give me some distance. There's a club night we're probably going to be starting in London as well. What else? Band stuff. I'm not sure what's happening. The Baby Chambers thing. I just go with the flow on that. I mean, it'll be happening at some point. I'm not sure. We'll see. What else? Yeah, this book, I need to finish this book. And my jazz playing, I'm like an amateur wannabe jazz guitar player. My goal is always to kind of run my own trio. I really like a lot of the like late 60s hard bop stuff. So that's coming together. You know, my teacher keeps grilling me, but, you know, I love it. I love learning those things. And now I've got more time. I like to try and practice if I can 2-3 hours a day. Just to kind of keep that development up. So that's what's in the pipeline. Yeah. And then defend this thesis and continue.
Unstoppable. I love that. I really appreciate the enthusiasm with which you kind of speak about all these different like parts of your lived experience. It seems like a really fun and rich life.
Yeah.
Although like incredibly busy. And so if people are curious about your work, where can they find you?
The music work, I guess, if they just go to my Instagram, there's all the links on that, which is just Adam Fychek. But any musicians that are struggling, I would recommend going to Tonic Music for mental health. I work a lot with them. I also run private practice, but the link is called Music and Mind. That's my private practice site. It's got a lot of media on there as well, so lots of interviews and articles I've written. But fundamentally, you know, for free mental health support, I can't emphasize this more. Tonic Music, Google Tonic Music, they offer free workshops. I run free peer groups with them. I don't know where this is going to, but Help Musicians UK, amazing. And the British Association of Performing Arts Medicine Trust, BAPAM, they all offer free advice because, you know, most musicians are going to probably be struggling. So anyone that's struggling, don't feel you're alone. There's loads of support that doesn't cost anything.
And is that specifically, especially except for the BPAM, are those available to people outside the UK also?
Help Musicians UK might not be, but I think they're trying to work out an part of their organization that does work outside. I don't know, to be honest. But obviously all of the online stuff, all of the Tonic Music stuff, yeah, that doesn't matter where you are.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, and I run the peer group there. So we do different 6-week peer groups. And they also run free workshops on like music performance anxiety, suicide awareness, and it's all free. You know, for me, the biggest worth I can give is to translate, here's all these resources, here's all these people struggling. This is why I do pop.
Connect them.
Predominantly, you know, I don't particularly need to sell anything myself, but I want to try to sell, here's free resources, here's struggling musicians, because sometimes it's not taken up and it's all there, you know. And I think when I was struggling at my most, I wasn't aware with it. Well, it didn't exist then, really. So I guess just trying to give something back in terms of, don't forget it's there. Don't forget, you know, it is a really massively hard struggle being a musician. Yeah, it's incredibly rewarding and rich and full of meaning. It doesn't mean it's valued by society in terms of you're going to get paid for it. That's the bottom line, as brutal as that sounds.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it sounds like you're really good at kind of naming and like delighting in the intrinsic motivators that we get to have in this line of work.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, you could think of it, if we have meaning, we have everything, you know, it's that which gives us meaning, and then money isn't so important. It's just a continuum. You know, if you've got a family, then you've got to pay the bills. And where do we then find time for our musicking, which is about us and our self-development and self-care? It's a real difficult one, but there is resources out there. So don't forget that, you know, like I say, those three organizations are key in helping musicians across the board, and not just UK as well. So.
Awesome. So just to close out, we're going to do a quick lightning round. Don't think too hard. What is your favorite food?
Curry.
Amazing. Mine too. What's a song that you have on repeat right now?
Who knows where the time goes? Sandy Denny.
Beautiful. Mm. What's the best way that you have found for yourself to reset if you're having a hard day?
Contact, connect with people that I trust and will kind of hear me and say, sound shit.
Holding the garbage can. Yeah. What turns you on? And that can be intellectually, creatively, sexually, what have you.
1968 British jazz.
Beautiful. What is a touring hack or your best advice for musicians who are on the road right now?
Don't get on the tour bus.
Terrible.
You know, for me, it was sleep. And the only way I could do that was hotels. Even if it's one every 3 days, if you're able to and the budget allows it. If not,
figure out how to sleep on the tour bus.
Yeah. I mean, sleep is massive, and we know from the literature it has one of the biggest impacts on, you know, mental health. And sometimes it's not possible, you know. And there's the thing about stimulants. If you're struggling with stimulants and sleeping, then something needs to be looked at. So support people. Yeah, people supporting you. Reaching out. That's it. It's my advice. Make sure you know about people like Tonic and Help Musicians and Bapam, and that there are people out there that have been through it, and there are strategies that they can offer.
Beautiful. And finally, what do you love?
My guitar.
Oh, what's your guitar? I'm curious.
It's not up there.
No, she's not there.
Yeah, it's normally hanging. Oh, no, where is it?
Oh, no, it's gone missing.
Oh, you see that? There's like a little guitar hook you can see just there, and it's not there.
Uh-huh. Uh-oh. We get a tour of the house now.
No, I've just got this is a Canadian guitar. So this is a Huss and Dalton. So I do a lot of writing on this. This has toured the world with me. So this is
lovely.
Yeah.
All the jazz practice is paying off.
Yeah. Folk and jazz. I like that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's good.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to reading the book when it comes out.
Yeah. Well, take care. Stay in touch and speak soon.
You too. Have a good one.
See you later.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth, sober, sex, all of this and more. Sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth.